when the problems in the Red Sea started at the end of 23, I mean, we had one of our ships also shot at, and one of our ships was actually hit. And if that drone would have hit a couple of boxes further to the back, we would have had a huge explosion because there was some hazardous goods in one of those boxes. So then it's not a very difficult decision, you know, to protect your people and to have them then sail around the Cape of Good Hope. I think the more difficult decision will be that at some point in time we will go back. And then the question will always be, when is it safe? And that will always be a subjective judgment. And of course, the day that we have to decide is coming closer.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged, real talk with the impactful. I'm David Bach. One of the organizations we've really enjoyed working with in 2025 is Hapag-Lloyd. I find the shipping industry fascinating because it's global and a real barometer of the global economy. That's why I was keen to have Rolf Habben Jansen, the CEO of Hapag-Lloyd, on the podcast. We discuss tariffs, safety in shipping, how many size 42 shoes you can fit into a container, what leaders in other industries can learn from shipping, and what ice hockey can teach us about leadership. Here's my conversation with Rolf Habben Jansen. So Rolf, you've been at the helm of Hapag-Lloyd since 2014. What do you like about the shipping industry?
I think the shipping industry is one of those where, you know, once you get into it, it's impossible to get out of it. Yeah, because it's a fascinating industry, which is truly global. And you are really exposed to everything that's happening around the world. If something happens geopolitically, it has an impact on us. If something happens with the weather, it has an impact to us. If some countries are booming, it has an impact on us. If some industry is starting to grow like crazy, we need to react. So I think it's very dynamic. It's very global. You meet people from all over the world. And I think that's where it's actually pretty addictive. And that's also why you see that most people that get into shipping never get out of it anymore.
So what is this current moment in shipping? What is it that we can learn about the world if we take a closer look at how shipping has been evolving?
Well, I think shipping is a good barometer of global GDP. Of course, we come out of 5 years that have been extraordinary good on the back of COVID, where everybody thought that the industry was going to go down big time, but then we had the biggest boom in history. And now you also see that things are cooling down and sort of getting back to normal. And that's just the process where people need to get used to.
So are these questions around the future of globalization, where economic growth is going to come from, are those some of the hardest challenges you're dealing with? Or
it's certainly one of the things that's the most difficult to predict. I mean, if I just look at the last 2 years, then everybody was pretty sure that in the beginning of 24 that, you know, the growth was going to slow down and the market would be flat at best. Last year, we saw 6.5% growth, which was the highest in a very long time. And then this year, the prediction was that things would at best going to be flat. We are year to date again, plus 4.7% or something like that. And also for next year, it's difficult to read what's really going to happen. And we are highly correlated to GDP growth, but there's probably still a number of other factors also that play a role that are maybe not so visible to everyone. I'll just give you one, yeah, which is how efficient supply chains have become and how much better packaging has become. If you look at televisions 10 years ago, they were huge, right? If you look at them today, instead of maybe having four or six on a pallet, you probably have 60 of the same size. If you look at mobile phones and the packages that they used to have were a lot bigger than what we see today. If you look at shoes, we used to do 800 pairs in a box. Now we do 1,200 pairs in a box. But at some stage, you reach the limit of that as well. So I think that especially that packaging element and the better utilization of containers is something that is reaching its limits. But that's also why I believe that growth could actually be a little bit higher than many people think.
That's fascinating. I mean, usually when you have a story about changes in product that don't get picked up in GDP, it's about the quality of the product. And you're saying there's a corollary here about the efficiency of packaging that somewhat decouples container volume to growth.
It does. I mean, if you go 10 or 15 years back, then the average cube utilization of a container was lower than it is today. I find the example of shoes always very fascinating. Yes, you can make the boxes smaller, but at some point, if you have shoe size 42, there's a limit to how small you can make the box. And we're getting to that. And those type of things have a huge impact on how many containers are being moved, because we don't move dollars, we move goods. And that's also why, you know, certain commodities are so important. I mean, when furniture is up, that has a huge impact because, you know, there can only go so many sofas in a container, whereas what happens to the semiconductor industry is not so relevant for container shipping because I don't know how many semiconductors you can put into a container, but it's a lot.
So what about regional dynamics? A couple of years ago, certainly in Europe, the focus was very much on de-risking from China. Others have gone even further and have talked about decoupling. But if you look at the volume of just high quality manufactured goods coming out of China, if anything, it seems to be increasing. You must be seeing that very clearly in terms of your shipping data.
Yeah, but also that again depends a little bit on commodities. I think there's many commodities where people have a China plus one or a China plus two type strategy already since many years because they try to diversify their supply chains. I think in general, that's a good idea. I think we've all learned throughout COVID that it's very risky to be dependent for certain commodities on only one source. And we've certainly seen over the last 4 or 5 years that that has really changed. But of course, there are also many goods that still come from China. And certainly, I mean, look at electric cars and solar panels. A lot of that stuff gets produced in China. And there you see limited diversification so far.
One really important issue on your agenda, on the agenda for your industry is of course, the energy transition and climate change. A few months ago, we had Morten Bo Christensen, head of energy transition at Maersk, and Bo Serap Simonsen from the Maersk McKinney Møller Center for Zero Carbon Shipping. I know you know them because you collaborate with the Center for Zero Carbon Shipping. There's a big effort to get an agreement at the IMO negotiated to put in place targets for the industry. And then it seems like at the last minute, the US and others intervened to put this off for a year. Can you talk a little bit about where you are at in terms of your sustainability journey and how this uncertainty, perhaps when it comes to global regulation, impacts the decisions that you make?
I think when you look at decarbonization or investing in sustainability as something that is there to stay, we're firmly convinced about that. We've put ourselves the ambition to be net carbon zero by 2045. And we've also put ourselves the ambition to reduce absolute emissions with about 30% until 2030. Those are tough targets, and those are not so easy to achieve. And of course, it's important that the industry has a little bit of a level playing field. And that's why the IMO is the regulator that should actually set those targets. And that's why it is also disappointing that this net zero framework was not accepted and yet pushed out. I think that will mean that it will take longer than a year before something will be agreed. Having said that, decarbonization and investing in sustainability will be themes over the next 10 or 20 years. So we still need to plan ahead and need to think about what we need to do in order to decarbonize our fleet. And that's where we are, of course, looking at all the ships that we build these days have dual fuel capabilities. That means they can sail on traditional bunker, but they can also sail on one of the fuels that can be more green, be it LNG, be it e-methane, be it potentially ammonia, be it green methanol. And I think that's what we need to do, because then at least we have the assets in our fleet that can run on those fuels once those become available. Because let's be clear, the biggest hurdle these days in shipping is the limited availability of green fuels. There's actually quite a lot of ships that are being built and that are in the order books that can sail on green fuels. There's much more capacity in the order book than that there is green fuels available. And that's, of course, where the type of things that you saw happening now at the IMO are not super helpful, because that will put some of those projects where people try to scale up production of green fuels further backwards.
Do you have a favorite, or is this an all-of-the-above approach when it comes to alternative fuels?
I think the verdict is still out. We have quite a lot of ships that can sail on LNG, because that's a fuel that's available today. We have just ordered a couple of weeks back some ships that can sail on green methanol. We have not yet done ammonia. I'm also not 100% convinced about that yet, I must admit, because it's quite toxic. And also the whole nitrogen emissions that come from that are not entirely trivial if you look at it from a greenhouse gas perspective. And last one that we also have on our radar screen is nuclear. I believe that with the newest techniques that we see in the nuclear field, around molten salt and other technologies, that it is very thinkable that in 15 years or so from today, especially the larger container ships can also sail on nuclear. Maybe not between every country, but if I look at a trade like China-US, I'd be very surprised if it's not present there.
You mentioned at the outset that one of the things that fascinates you about the shipping industry is that you really are a barometer in terms of the global economy, but also global politics. One way in which this manifests itself is that when there's trouble somewhere in the world, you often need to adapt, and you might have to adapt one day to the next. I think the place where most people have gotten a sense of this is when it comes to safety around the Horn of Africa and the implications for shipping routes. Can you tell us a little bit where you're at right now, but perhaps more importantly, how do you make decisions about routing ships? I mean, this has implications for your customers, for their customers. How do you get your arms around this issue?
That's difficult because, you know, it's very difficult to write a scenario on those type of things. When the problems in the Red Sea started at the end of 23, I mean, we had one of our ships also shot at, and one of our ships was actually hit. And if that drone would have hit a couple of boxes further to the back, we would have had a huge explosion because there was some hazardous goods in one of those boxes. So then it's not a very difficult decision, you know, to protect your people and to have them then sail around the Cape of Good Hope. I think the more difficult decision will be that at some point in time, we will go back. And then the question will always be, when is it safe? And that will always be a subjective judgment. And of course, the day that we have to decide is coming closer. When it's exactly going to happen, I think that's still too early to say. But we can clearly see that some of the tensions that were there 6 months ago are probably less today. And that means that the likelihood that at some point in time we go back is of course higher now than it was 3 or 6 months ago. And that's when we have to talk to our people, that's when we have to talk to our partners, and then have to make some kind of judgment on when to come back. And more importantly, to then also decide how to go back. Because if all of a sudden we would go back through Suez, then all the ports in Europe will collapse. Because you will have a lot of ships overtaking each other, which means that during certain weeks, many of the ports have to handle double the amount of volume that they have today. And they for sure can't do that because they're just not equipped for that. And that's then something that we need to prevent. So we hope that at some stage we'll be able to have a gradual return to Suez, hopefully over a 60 or 90 day period.
And it's obvious that this requires a lot of coordination, but also it seems that there's a lot of collaboration. And I know that you worked with Maersk on this Gemini project to deal with the implications of no longer sailing through the Suez Canal. Can you explain to people what that is, what you achieved, and the role that collaboration, even among formal competitors, plays in an industry such as yours?
We've agreed to team up between Maersk and Hapag because we felt that one could design a better network on the East-West trades to give our customers better service. We promised at that point in time that we'd deliver a 90% schedule reliability. That's also something that we have done. And as such, I think it's fair to say that most of the customers today would see the product that Maersk and we deliver as better than the other products that are available in the market, which is exactly what we wanted to achieve. In a case like this, when it's around Suez, of course, there you have to take a joint decision on what you do. The Suez crisis started actually before we were working together with Maersk, because that was end of 23 and our operational cooperation only started in the beginning of 25. But that does mean that we also built two networks between us and said, you know, either we have a Suez network and we have a network that we operate if we go around the Cape of Good Hope. And then we had to decide to go around the Cape. So that's the network that we operate today. And now we have to see what's going to happen in the course of 26.
Do you have advice for CEOs who might be struggling with the idea of cooperating? I talked to a lot of CEOs who, you know, their natural sort of instinct is to compete. And sometimes they struggle a little bit to pick up the phone and call a competitor and say, why don't we join forces?
Yeah, but in this case, of course, it's a pure operational cooperation. I mean, we're fierce competitors on the market. But in a way, you can compare it also with some of the alliances that you see in the airline industry. I mean, I always use United and Lufthansa, which work together since a very long time, especially on transatlantic. And that works really, really well. I mean, you see the same with Air France, KLM and Delta. So it's more that type of cooperation what you have. You still try to sell individually. It's just that you create a better network together, which gives your customers in the end more choices.
So I like the focus on customer value, and it brings me to something I wanted to ask about, which is you've set a goal for Hapag-Lloyd to be the undisputed number one when it comes to quality. So clearly that's where we can see that competitive spirit. What does that mean? What does that look like when you're the number one for quality. How do you bring that to all the different parts of your operations around the world? What do you have to do as a leader to get the entire organization to embrace this idea of being number one for quality?
I think, first of all, it's definitely a long journey. I think we started defining that we wanted to differentiate through quality in 2017. So that's already 8 years ago. And it's also fair to say that in the beginning, I think there was a fair bit of skepticism in our own organization as well, because quality was not something that had a very high priority in shipping as an industry. When I looked at it as a, having been a forwarder for a long time, I always said that, you know, that shipping lines really don't understand the concept of customer service. And that's, of course, where it starts, because quality in the end has two important components. One is the service component, and the second one is the operational component. We started with the service component. And there, when you start measuring what you're doing, you will very quickly find out that some of the reasons why customers don't rate you very high are pretty basic. When we started measuring how long it took us to respond to emails or how often we picked up the phone, you came up with some very interesting data points every now and then. And when you then start working on that, and when you systematically improve that, and you also make sure that we deliver what we promise, then that really helps. And we measure service quality based on customer surveys and NPS scores and those type of things. And there we have seen that, you know, going from, I think we were at minus 20 or something like that when we started, when you look at NPS, we then gradually improved. And I think we're now pretty stable at around 60, 65 plus, which for a business like ours is pretty good. As we saw that our service quality was actually pretty decent some years ago, we knew we could still get better, but we also saw that there was a disconnect between the service quality and the quality image that we wanted to have and the operational quality that we were actually delivering to our customers, which was then the reason why we were prepared to think about changing the cooperation that we at that time had with our Asian partners to a cooperation with Maersk, because we felt that when it's about the things that we feel are important, that we were closer to them than to our former Asian partners. And that doesn't mean that our former Asian partners are wrong. It's just that we had a different perspective on what is it that we really want to deliver to our customers, where for us, on-time performance and schedule reliability were really important. And for the others, that was probably a little bit less so. And they had other things that they felt were important. When you talk, who do you want to work with and who are your partners? You have to find people that are like-minded and where you have some kind of strategic alignment if you really want to make progress. And that's, if you look at where we are today, then we're definitely there on the schedule reliability. We still have something to do on OTD. We're definitely there on the customer service quality. And that means that I think we are on a good track to deliver on that strategic ambition, even if we know that also everybody else always gets better. So it's a sort of race that never ends.
So we're speaking at a time when a lot of European industry is trying to figure out what the right path forward is. A lot of uncertainty, a lot of competition, especially from Asia. This focus on quality and reliability, is that where you would think more European business and industry leaders should emphasize? Have we been too focused on efficiency and we need to remind ourselves that it is about being reliable and delivering quality for our customers?
I think it's difficult to say that in general. But I think when you look at Europe, if you are a business that's largely based in Europe, then to win purely based on low cost is probably tough. If you look at our industry, then it's important to be cost competitive. And that's where it's important that you buy the right ships, that you use the right type of fuel, that you negotiate your terminal contracts properly, and that your overhead is under control. But in our business, personnel costs are less than 10% of the overall cost. So whilst it is important, it's not necessarily decisive. And when you look at other industries where that plays an even bigger role, yeah, I would also argue that in many cases, you have to ask yourself the question, how am I going to win? And if you are based in Germany or in Western Europe, then to win purely based on cost is in many industries probably tough.
Yeah. So I like that. So you got to do the basics, have your costs under control, but understand that you're not just winning on cost. You have to win on quality and reliability when it comes to your customer.
I think so. I think if you're based in Western Europe, then you have to be able to deliver something that can also be sometimes a unique customer experience if you are in tech or if you are in the service industry. But you have to be able to differentiate from your competition. And if you look at our competition is truly global. And there we know that our cost base is certainly not the lowest. We can still be competitive, but we certainly won't have the lowest cost. Also because Hapag-Lloyd is number five in our industry, and that means that we have a certain scale disadvantage as well compared to number one, two, and three.
Are you concerned that the direction of U.S. foreign policy, the increase of tariffs to the highest level in almost a century, that that is going to globally diminish trade of physical goods, or is that ultimately going to be just a speed bump on the road towards global integration?
I see that probably indeed more as a speed bump. I mean, in the beginning of the year, we were all talking about tariffs that could be 30, 40, 50%. With many of the countries, things now get settled at 15. That's still not great, but it's certainly a lot better than 30 or 40. And I think what you also see is other countries talking to each other and trying to create free trade zones, trying to close other trade agreements. So I think it's not impossible that if you fast forward 5 or 10 years, that the role of the US in international trade is a little bit smaller. But I do think that we'll still see quite a lot of growth in many other markets. I mean, if you look at Southeast Asia, if you look at India, if you look at Africa, if you look at Latin America, then there's still quite a lot of potential for further growth and even in some markets also for containerization. I mean, if you look at the number of containers that's being moved in and out of China and you compare that to India, then you can certainly argue whether the volumes in and out of India are going to double or triple over the next 10 or 15 years, but they will for sure not stay the same.
So it's a rewiring of globalization, if you will, as opposed to sort of the end of globalization.
Yeah, I think it's just a further development where you will just see that some other markets are going to potentially take over a little bit the role that the United States has played for so long.
So there's this famous book by Mark Levinson that I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, The Box on the History of the Container. Are you one of those people who believes that the container changed the world?
It did. Yeah. I mean, for sure, it has made global trade so much more efficient. I think from that perspective, it's really been a revolution. I mean, if you look at also how ports look these days, how ship looks these days, and if you just compare it to 25 years ago, I was just reading this morning someone who had put out a bit of a history on how quickly have all of those companies grown in container shipping. Just Hapag-Lloyd, for example, as in 2010, we had a standing capacity of 450,000 containers. Today, we have close to 2.5 million. And then we are not even the ones that have grown the fastest, but still we're five times the size that we were in 2010.
It is interesting, right? If you think about it, how industries that can look mature can continue to innovate. I mean, what you shared before about packaging becoming more efficient, new types of technologies, the only mature companies and not mature industries, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the industry is maturing, but there's still more that can be done. If you also just look at what's being invested in terminals around the globe, it's still a lot. And that is also because there will still be quite a lot more growth to come over the next 10 or 20 years.
So I'd love to come back to you as a leader. Since I assumed this role of being president of IMD a little over a year ago, I've had a sticky note on my computer that says, what is it that only I can do? So my first question is, what is it that only you can do in the organization? And my second question is, do you have any other tools that you use to help yourself to focus on the essential?
I don't think there's anything only I can do, because in the end, what you do as a leader of a large organization is you try to help your people and you try to guide your people and you try to communicate clearly about what is expected and you try to be honest and transparent about what's going on, because I think that's in the end what builds trust. But that's pretty much, I think, what you can do. I don't think there is anything that only one person can do for any company. If you look at research, then you will also find out that whether companies are successful, yes or no, I think it's 96% or so driven by the market that they are in, and 4 or 5% or so the way that they manage that. And maybe it's 90-10, but it just illustrates once more how important it is to find the right markets to play in. And then that will drive to a very large extent whether you're successful. And apart from that,
you know, there are a lot of big egos in the C-suite that are not going to be happy to hear that it's really not about them.
Yeah, but then I think if, you know, if they would do their research, that they will also find out that the market is more important, yeah, than an individual. And of course, you know, there are exceptions like, you know, Steve Jobs, who did great things with Apple. But, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of managers and thousands of CEOs of large companies around the globe. And for most of them, their success is to a fairly large extent driven by the markets that they are in. That doesn't mean that you cannot make a difference, you know, and that doesn't mean that you cannot make an impact. But those are two very different things.
You mentioned how your industry is a barometer of what's happening. It's so connected to economic trends, political trends, technological trends, social trends. One of the things that we're trying to do here at IMD is help leaders across many different industries adapt to a more uncertain world, a world with more volatility. What are some of the things that you and your team, or perhaps your industry as a whole, have developed in leaders around agility, resilience, reliability, that you think other industries and other industry leaders could learn from?
It's a good question. I think what we started with is that, you know, our industry is so global and you're exposed to so many different things that I do believe that managers in our industry get exposed probably more than in many other industries to impulses from everywhere around the globe. They also learn to understand what are the cultural differences and how does that actually impact how people behave. And I think that because of that, they are generally fairly resilient, yeah. Also because it's a very cyclical industry. I mean, we have years where it's going very well, and we have also years where it's not so good or not good at all. And then you still need to remain calm, you know, and try to do whatever you can to steer the ship through somewhat rougher water. So I think when you look at what can we learn, I think it's resilience. And the other thing is learning from many different impulses that you get from all the connections that we have around the globe.
Do your leaders spend time on ships? Is that part of the... I was going to say onboarding, but that would be almost a little bit too point in term.
We try to, but we should spend more time on ships, and we visit the ships every now and then, but we should probably still spend more time on that. But we do spend time with the captains, we do spend time with the crews, we do spend time in, or listening to our people from fleet on what keeps them busy. We spend a lot of time on working on seafarer well-being, because those things are important, because for many angles have the toughest jobs in our industry, and their jobs have certainly not become easier over the last 4 or 5 years, as we see that regulations have become stricter and stricter, especially for seafarers.
When you look into 2026, maybe ahead to 2027, how's the world shaping up? What is it that you're preparing for?
We're preparing for possibly one or two more difficult years, because I think that global growth will slow down a bit. And that means that also because there are quite a lot of new ships that are coming into the market, that there are potentially going to be a couple of quarters where supply and demand are not fully balanced. And then we just need to be able to react to that and do all the things everybody does and in those times, which is take out costs and make sure that we remain or become as lean as we can be. Having said that, if I look a little bit longer term, I'm still cautiously optimistic that we'll continue to see fairly healthy growth in this industry. And that means that also in future, it should be possible for us to continue to differentiate based on quality. And based on that, we should be able to attract sufficient cargo at reasonable prices to make a living. And there's not really a good alternative for container transport, also not in the future. So as such, I think it is going to continue to be a market that's going to remain dynamic, where I think the importance of markets is going to shift, but it will remain very much a global industry, which will, I'm convinced, is also going to continue to grow with maybe 3 or 4% a year, which is not small, yeah, if you look at the size of the industry as a whole.
Last question, Rolf. I know you're a big ice hockey fan. Are there any leadership lessons in ice hockey?
Well, I think one of the lessons is that, you know, if you are on the ice, you have to give it all you can. It's not for nothing that a shift of a typical forward is less than 45 seconds and then they go off again. I think it's a little bit the same in life. Whatever you do, try to do it you know, with conviction and try to give it 100% every day. And that's, I think, what people can expect from you. And that's certainly something you can learn from hockey as well.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. It's so rare to meet a CEO who says, you know, I'm really not all that important. It's all about the others. There's a lot that we can learn from Rolf. Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Delia Fisher, Felix Seltner, and Robert Debus. Subscribe to Leaders Unplugged on your favorite podcast platform. I'm David Bach. See you soon.